Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, celebrating 30 years as local hearing healthcare professionals. With a practice featuring 5 doctors of audiology, including 2 who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient. They believe those personal partnerships are how people embrace hearing technology and keep hearing the most important sounds of their lives. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Remote learning has shaken up the way educators teach and how teachers measure student growth. Some worry students may fall behind without in-person instruction. The fear is more for students already struggling in school. Educators say just because learning looks different during the pandemic doesn't mean students do worse. Dana Vollmer reports some argue now is the time to reconsider how to assess students.
The question, how are students performing, is not straightforward this school year. Most students have learned virtually since March. Lessons aren't the same as in the classroom, and neither are the ways educators grade them. Diane Wolf is Assistant Superintendent of Curriculum and Instruction for District 87. She says the traditional A, B, C, D, F grading system doesn't mean the same now.
Have students going through a traumatic event as a society. So if we continue to use the same benchmarks that we always have, what does that say about us as educators? We really should be taking this time to teach kids resiliency, new ways of looking at things. And so the A may be that for right now, our benchmark has changed.
She says that might mean A students just show up for remote learning every day, give it their best shot, learn new technologies, and cope with the stress of a global health emergency. It may not be traditional, but Wolf says she guarantees no one is sitting around not learning anything.
That's really important that we do not discredit what's happening every day in family life. You know, we have kids that are learning fractions because they're baking with a parent or a guardian. They're not doing it on a worksheet, maybe, but they're actually doing and applying the skills. We have students that are reading for how to maneuver a new game that they want to play. That's still reading.
It's too soon to tell how COVID-19 hinders student performance. Projections by the Brookings Institute before school began suggested students would return this fall with 70% of gains in reading from the previous year. The number is lower for math, less than 50% retention. Brookings researchers suggest younger students lose more. But early data from student assessments this fall show students fared better than originally feared. Wolf says she does not worry students will lose an entire year of learning. She says they may need to shore up certain skills, but that's true every school year. State Superintendent Carmen Ayala says students can learn without traditional grades as long as they get assessment and feedback.
So what does that look like? We're encouraging our educators to use ungraded polls, to use surveys, quick writes, interviews, mini conferences, and learning logs to help students synthesize learning and help teachers gauge students' progress.
Ayala says formats like multiple choice and true-false may be easier to administer, especially in a remote environment, but they don't reveal enough about student understanding. With students out of the classroom, faculty do fewer competency and readiness checks on growth. For instance, Bloomington High School and some others canceled final exams. The state encourages educators to prioritize project-based learning, to talk about where kids need more supports, and to have students write about what they've learned. Ayala says these principles should transcend remote learning. Many teachers have pushed for alternative ways to measure student growth for years. That's what the whole standards-based grading movement is about. Lindsay DiMartino with ISU's College of Education says the pandemic is a good opportunity to think about what education can be rather than default to the status quo. DiMartino says the stakes are now higher for some students.
There's cause to be concerned over running the risk of broadening and reinforcing the social divide. So then emerging from the digital divide, the social divide results in an online penalty where it's more severe for struggling and vulnerable students.
D. DiMartino says the learning outcomes have less to do with students and more to do with how schools provide equitable and inclusive education, and student assessments are part of that. Educators are adjusting to the digital divide by altering course structure. Sarah Deal Hunt is Heartland Community College's enrollment chief. She says teachers are scaling back to the bare essentials to make it less overwhelming for students. Deal Hunt says they change when they introduce some course material so students can catch up if they miss something.
So that if a student does take a little bit longer to get acclimated and get the hang of things, they haven't fallen so far behind that they get discouraged. So offering opportunities toward the mid and latter parts of courses to make up ground for shown improvement.
District 87's Diane Wolf says she understands concerns about students' performance, but she says it's up to parents and teachers to make sure students keep up.
This idea that students are going to be behind is a really scary narrative to tell kids. As the adults in a child's life, it is our job to remind them of what they have learned and what they can learn, instead of looking at this experience as the worst thing that's ever happened to them.
Wolf says when students return to the classroom, the focus will be on moving forward, not what they missed by being remote. I'm Dina Vollmer.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Across Illinois, more than 80% of ICU beds are now occupied. That's according to data from the state's Department of Public Health. And it's raising concerns hospitals might fill up in the coming weeks. Christine Herman speaks with ER Dr. Ernest Wong. He's past president of the Illinois College of Emergency Physicians and chief of emergency medicine at North Shore in Evanston.
The Midwest has really been hit quite hard this second go-around, probably more so than the first time. What I think a lot of us are seeing is higher numbers that look just unbelievable, the way that the curve is going up. We have more hospitalizations now than we did in the spring, but we're putting less people on ventilators overall, although, you know, we're starting to track that going up too, and that seems to be the pattern, right? The cases go up, the hospitalizations go up, and then ICU use goes up, and then you have ventilator use go up. And so I think we're all now just waiting to see what that's going to look like, how that's going to peak out. I don't know if we know for sure.
Lately, we've been hearing news about hospitals across the country filling up. Several hospitals in central Illinois that I've checked in with more recently, you know, areas that didn't really get hit that hard in that first wave the way that maybe Chicago and the collar counties did, they've reported having actually reached full capacity at certain times in recent weeks. And I know you don't have a crystal ball to predict the future, but at the same time, there are models that public health folks and hospital workers look at to make predictions. So I'm curious to hear what your sense is of whether Illinois hospitals will run out of space and when that would happen and what that would actually look like. What would happen in that case?
The number of medical surgical beds is going down. I haven't looked at the IDPH website, but if you look at the website, there's the fuel gauges on bed availability. I'm sure we're all getting down below 20% around the state. And you're right, you know, the whole state has turned red, if you will, from infection, whereas before it was mostly in the Chicagoland area. And yeah, I think we're all concerned about what that's going to look like the next couple weeks.
I mean, I imagine there's the hard conversations you have to have as a hospital system. What will we do if it comes to that, right? Like, what are some of the questions you're mulling over in those conversations?
Well, we're thinking about several things. How do we provide care for not only the COVID patients, but non-COVID patients? Because, you know, ethically, you have to be able to treat everybody. And, you know, we have to talk about what kinds of cases do we really, you know, should we be providing, you know, the full extent of care? What patients, you know, will the treatments benefit? It becomes a use-benefit question. If I'm in a high-risk category, I have a very severe case, and it doesn't look like, you know, it's going to be, you know, a good outcome, you know, I think there needs to be discussions about what is realistic.
Are these truly unprecedented times, unprecedented numbers of patients receiving care in the ERs and ICUs right now? Have Illinois hospitals ever been through anything like this in the recent past?
Not to this extent. And the difference between the second go-around and the first go-around is, you know, I don't think we're unusual in that not only are we seeing large numbers of patients coming in with COVID, but people who have non-COVID conditions are still coming in. Whereas in the first wave, they stayed home in general. And in this second wave, when I look at our numbers, the majority of people are still coming in for non-COVID related complaints. And so now we have to be able to manage not only the COVID patients, but the non-COVID patients. And so that is also taxing the capacity even more.
What is it like for ER doctors and nurses right now who've been running full steam for 8-9 months now with no really clear end in sight? Can you talk about what it's like to be on the hospital floor?
We talked about a lot. You know, I think a lot of us are tired. This has been going on for, you know, since March. And even though the end is potentially in sight now, and, you know, we're hearing good news about vaccines, and so there is hope. And, you know, in the scheme of things, I tell people this, you know, compared to the flu pandemic in 1918, which was many years long, you know, this has not even been a year. So, you know, I look at it from a glass half full. But a lot of us are very tired now. We're not as, I think, fearful of the disease. We know what it is, what it presents like, and how we treat it. We're doing a great job of treating it better. And as long as we have the proper PPE, we're well protected, and we know that now. But it is hard to watch all the stuff going on, people going out, and, you know, you want people to try and socially distance, wear a mask, and, you know, there's so many conflicting messages, and just to watch, you know, all the big get-togethers, and, you know, it's hard to watch. It is hard to watch.
I wanted to follow up on the last thing you said, just about how hard it is to see people kind of ignoring these guidelines, which maybe people are tired of hearing: wear a mask, keep your distance, avoid gatherings. Like, do you worry people are getting tired of this? And what would you say to someone who feels like, I'm just going to let my guard down because I'm tired and I don't think this is that serious?
Yeah. Well, I'd say a couple things. Number one, I would say I understand your point of view, because you're tired, I'm tired, we're all tired. Okay. And let's be real. Humans, you know, a rubber band, right, in its unstressed form, if you stretch it out, right, there's tension and it wants to come back together. And when you separate humans apart from each other for a long period of time, the natural tendency is to come back together. And that's human nature. That's the way we are. And that's okay. So I understand this, and I understand why people would think that way. And so that would be my first response, is I understand it, I get it, I'm with you. Okay, but once again, you know, I'm reminded that, you know, in our country, in the United States, freedom isn't free. Freedom isn't free, you know, except now that instead of soldiers, the freedom that we enjoy, the privilege to freely move about the country, our communities, the ability to not be subject to mandatory mask mandates, to have some personal jurisdiction over that, and to the liberty to make personal decisions about wearing a mask, those are being preserved by the healthcare workers, the first responders, essential workers. Those are the people risking their lives to preserve those freedoms. But more importantly, I think the cost that this freedom is costing is the human lives that have been lost, right? 260,000 lives. I mean, it's hard to register that number. And I worry that it's just going to be a number that we just kind of watch tick up and up and up, and we don't think about, you know, what each life meant. So in the lives that are lost, those that died, you know, in large part, many of them can't exercise the freedom that we have. Okay, they're the elderly, the sick, the poor, the, you know, intergenerational households, minorities, those who can't escape exposure. So that's why, you know, freedom isn't free. And if we want to make sure that, you know, our country remains free, and if we're to have any hope of breaking the chain of transmission, we need to acknowledge our own personal obligations.
That's ER Dr. Ernest Wong, past president of the Illinois College of Emergency Physicians. He spoke with Christine Herman. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Heartland Theater returns to the airwaves with a new radio adaptation of a classic holiday tale, inspired by a work of O. Henry. The production takes a fresh approach to a well-known story while remaining true to its heartfelt message. WGLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
The Gift of the Magi was penned by O. Henry in 1906. Over 100 years later, Heartland Theater presents a new version of the holiday classic, airing on WGLT and WCBU on December 11th at 8 p.m. Sandra Zielinski is the director of the play, a sentimental tale that deals with love and sacrifice. Zielinski says the script was written specifically for radio by West Coast writer Bob Cooner, who, through the marvels of technology, actually got the unique opportunity to sit in with the cast during rehearsal.
So all of the actors got to see the playwright and see how overjoyed he was that we're doing his play. He's from the West Coast, so, you know, we zoomed him in, as all of the actors were zoomed in, as well as our artistic staff. And so it was a great meeting. It was like Hollywood Squares. You know, you see all these people.
This is an old story, originally written around 1906, I believe. Bob Cooner's adaptation actually moves the action forward in time to the World War I era. Sandra, how does that impact the classic O. Henry story by setting it in World War I?
Well, we have a lot of people who are out of work. They need money. They need to be able to have a job, to have money so that they can, at this time of the year, celebrate Christmas, not only with food, but with gifts to their loved ones. So I think it fits perfectly into the scheme that O. Henry was writing about. What Bob Cooner did was take all of the characters that they would have met and brought them into the story, where O. Henry has a third-person point of view. So he's looking at both of them and commenting on what they're doing. And actually, in the text, the O. Henry text, it's James and Della who have one conversation that we read, and that's of the giving of the gifts. And only one other person is also included in this script. It is our woman who cuts Della's hair. She has some words. You know, it's Madame Sofrani. So those are the only three characters that O. Henry gives language to. And, in the play script, we meet Sofrani, we meet the pawn shop owner, we meet the sergeant, we meet a lot of other people that they would have come in contact with. So it's really very interesting. He takes a broader view of the story, where O. Henry just focuses very tight on Della's hair and the watch fob. So it's really interesting, and I think Bob has done a great job with filling out their life so that we see it in a different way.
Is this an easy tale to relate via radio? Do you think that this really naturally adapts itself to a radio format?
Yes. Gail is the stage manager for me, Gail Dobbins, and she sees it on the stage. I mean, she's already costumed them in her mind. It really brings this story to life. And I think it's very easy to do over the radio, because we don't have a third person, right? Nobody is telling the tale. They are living the tale. So it's I think it's an interesting process. In directing, I don't look at the Zoom picture, because the face tells us so much, right? And now the voice has to do that for the actors. And so I don't look at them when I'm listening to them. That's how you do it. Because if you look at them, you think that they are doing what you see, but maybe they aren't vocally. So it's an interesting process.
That's Heartland Theater's Sandra Zielinski, director of The Gift of the Magi, airing on WGLT and WCBU December 11th at 8 p.m. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can hear about one of the biggest challenges facing the cast of The Gift of the Magi in bonus audio at our website, WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media. I'm Charlie Schlenker.